Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Coffee Talk. I'm joined here by Michael Lumpers. Michael?
Buddy, once again, it's a pleasure to be here on Coffee Talk, the only podcast hosted by the NATO Association of Canada that offers thought-provoking analysis on the issues of the day. But enough with the pleasantries. Let's give the people what they want. Let's talk.
We're here with Yvonne Soricho, too, who is joining us for this particular talk. Hello.
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 Well, we are starting today, and I think we are delving into discussion about ISIS. But I think, for the most part, people have been looking at ISIS and looking at this issue as a way to liberate, quote-unquote, Mosul from ISIS and to enable Iraq to at least function somewhat as a state, as a federal state. But I think our perspective here will be a bit different. I think what we should be talking about is what happens after ISIS. I mean, what will be happening after ISIS? From a theoretical perspective, from a government side perspective, what should happen in Iraq? What should happen in the countries surrounding it as if and when ISIS is removed from having this much control of this much land in Iraq? And one of the reasons I'm bringing this up is because even though they are removing ISIS as an organized or occupying force, they're not really removing the ideology. And no. I can tell you this much, the sleeper cells that actually rose up in Kirkuk a few days ago, or the bombings that happened in Baghdad a few months ago by ISIS, who claimed sort of responsibility for it, is not going away.
And in fact, I mean, from a Western perspective, as you well know, a lot of Western intelligence agencies have gone on record to state that as ISIS loses territory, this by no means, this does not mean that the threat of exported terrorism declines. I mean, on the contrary, that as ISIS loses territory, it's many intelligence agencies have opined that those who have gone over to fight on behalf of ISIS will now start trickling home. They'll start trickling home, and there's the threat that these fighters who have been fighting over in Iraq and Syria will apply the lessons learned from those fights and now go home and wreak havoc. This is the theory. Yeah. This is a threat that's not about to go away, obviously.
Wouldn't you say that aspect is inevitable? Once a group like ISIS loses territorial integrity, they will go underground. They have to. That's the next phase for them because they do not control a territory or land for them to launch. You know,
right? In that sense, they'll be a more traditional terrorist organization, one that does not hold territory, one that does not govern, one that does not have institutions that can be struck.
So my next question is: isn't that viewed? Because it's inevitable, isn't that viewed as a, it might sound very incorrect to say, but isn't that viewed as a positive sign that they no longer have land, that they are forced to go underground? That's sort of the next step to defeating them as an organization.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, sure. But the question is, what should Iraq do now? What should the international community do in order to counteract the threat of ISIS as they are being removed? I mean,
I think we were talking about this on a previous edition of Coffee Talk, the only podcast hosted by the NATO Association that offers thought-provoking analysis on the pressing international issues of the day. We were talking about this before, and missing from this debate, especially if you've been watching the series of debates between Clinton and Trump. They seem to be trying to outdo each other in terms of who can be tougher on ISIS and who can bomb the most, et cetera. And the thing that I find troubling about this is that, I don't think this is, you can deny them territory. You can even pound them into the ground. But, the conditions that have given rise to groups like ISIS or its predecessor Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the conditions will remain. And what people need to start addressing and thinking about you know, after bombing ISIS, after denying them territory, is how can you address the conditions that have given rise to such a group? And I don't think anything less than dramatic reform in domestic governance in these countries can address that. Nothing short of that mm-hmm. can address that.
On this note, what I mean though is, you know, what should happen in Iraq now that ISIS is no longer there? I mean, how do you deal with the children that have been, quote unquote, you know, educated by ISIS and its ideology for the last two and a half years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you deal with the people that have lived under ISIS and its ideology for the last number of years? And how do you in sort of bring them back into the fold without actually ostracizing them,
mm-hmm.
without actually making them feel that they are unwelcomed in Iraq?
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, how do you ensure that you punish those responsible for the genocide that ISIS has committed?
Yeah, it's a very fine balance.
So one aspect to look at, and one that is gaining a lot of speed in American politics especially, is looking at the future of Iraq as a federalist system. Basically, decentralizing the power Baghdad has over the different provinces, different governorates in Iraq. Once that happens, the people within the different provinces, you could say, will have their own say in their internal affairs. That will be something that is being pushed for, and that is something that might potentially bring different communities that were and continue to fight each other back into the fold.
So in such a scenario, then, would the central government in Baghdad then be basically responsible for things like foreign affairs, and most of the other most other domestic matters would be mm-hmm. those
provincial
would be
matters.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
So with a weaker central government, the provinces have more autonomy.
Yeah.
With that, they can start taking care of their own people. And in Middle Eastern societies, it's very divided. Different provinces, different even cities are divided. Neighborhoods are divided within different ethnic or religious backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you bring that out to the provincial level with more autonomy, the provinces are going to be happier because now they could take care of their own populace.
But
one
I think
issue
that also
with
applies
that
to places like the United States or even in
mm-hmm.
Canada. I mean, Canada is a federation. It
mm-hmm.
is not an alliance or union between provinces, and so you still have external affairs dealt with by the federal government, while local matters that really affect the population, education,
health,
et cetera, are all dealt with by the provinces.
Absolutely,
The issue with that is that even in a federalist system, the small minority populations will be forgotten. Because if the provinces stay the way they are today and there's no reshaping of the boundaries within governorates, the minorities will be still under influence of another. Even though Sunni Arabs are a minority in whole of Iraq, they are a majority in, let's say, Nineveh.
Sure.
So then the minorities, such as Yazidis, Assyrians, Shabaks, Turkmen, they're going to be still under the authority of in Nineveh,
larger,
the majority Sunni Arab population, and vice versa in different regions.
Yeah.
So a federalist system needs to be in place, but needs to also keep in mind the different ethnic and minority backgrounds within the different regions that will be fed in a federalist system.
So essentially bringing a place for everybody. That's
mm-hmm.
another part
what
of the larger
of, but,
solution.
I mean, you know, and to make to have this be a viable option, I mean, you know, we have to ask, is this sort of arrangement something that enjoys widespread support among Iraqis? Is this something that regional powers would be willing to acquiesce to? You know, there are a whole bunch of factors here which enter into the equation.
This is the problem.
Mm.
I think the problem here is A, the political will. I don't think it really does exist in Iraq to do any of this. And two, I think what we are really seeing is I guess a more complex issue on how to actually, I mean, will these people come back to their villages and their towns
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the people that have fled? Will these places return to their multi-ethnic, multi-religious, cosmopolitan self? Or did we really ethnically cleanse all these people and it's over? And if that's the case, then we really have to look at these issues differently than if these people are willing to come back. All signs lead that these people, a lot of them will come back, but a lot of them have also left Iraq and are now seeking asylum elsewhere in the world.
Sure. So for me, in terms of answering your question, the only segment that I would say would be against such a system would be the majority Shia Arab population. Yeah. However, I can say that looking at the Maliki days, that the people
Maliki
were
being the former prime minister,
prime minister of Iraq, that even the Shia who was his base support, they were also fed up with it because with the system, because again he was all about centralizing power in Baghdad, he was all about, you know, gaining control for his party, so on and so forth. So even the populace that would want a centralized, strong Baghdad government has been sort of through what happened with ISIS and the Sunni, I guess you could call it uprising. They have been sort of shying away from a strong central government.
Yeah.
So even so, we are seeing some forms of concessions given to other peoples in the different provinces, especially the Sunnis. And another note is the liberation of Mosul. It's sort of reinvigorating a sense of Iraqi nationalism, which has been very rare since the start of the Iraq War in 2003. Where people are coming in and fighting together as Iraqis, and I think it was Barzani, prime minister of the Kurdish region,
regional government in Iraq.
He said that this is the first time that the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga, which is the Kurdish security forces, are fighting together. First time in history.
What about these reports you hear of Shia militias, though? Who? You know, you read these stories about how these Shia militias who are part of these fights to liberate these cities or provinces, and you read these accounts about how they sort of come in and, you know, oppress the local Sunni population.
Yep.
They round them up. They do, you know, God knows what could be worse. You know, they do things worse than that. But, well, I mean – you know, what do you make of that?
So there have been many reports. I think Amnesty International has published a lot of articles about it, and they're called the PMU, Popular Mobilization Units. And within, it's an umbrella organization.
Or Hashd-Shabi, in Arabic.
Yeah.
They are essentially militias that are funded by
Iran?
Iraqi government.
Okay.
And local, essentially they're controlled by local, what I would really call warlords.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
doesn't this really throw a wrench in the works in terms of if you're talking about post-war accommodation and rehabilitation and bringing the country together in the sense of Iraqi nationalism? Doesn't this sort of throw a wrench in the works of that?
So the PMU is essentially an umbrella organization of different militias. There's many militias within it, majority obviously being Shia-dominated militias, and they're probably a vast majority of the militias and numbers within PMU. However, there are still Sunni tribal militias, a lot around functioning in Anbar and Nineveh provinces. There's also militias, for example, Nineveh Plain Protection Unit is also part of the PMU.
Yes, yeah.
So there's a
the
Turkmen.
The Nineveh Plains are essentially a Syrian Christian militia, established to liberate Assyrian towns and villages from ISIS, or to help to do so.
Yeah,
and also what there's also Turkmen militias part of it. But you are right; the overarching majority is are Shia militias.
Yeah.
However, the government has taken note of that and has taken note of all the different abuses, you could say, that have been reported on the PMU.
Yeah.
And they have said that the PMU will not enter Mosul itself.
Okay.
They made that concession that no PMU soldiers will enter, and even no Peshmerga Kurdish soldiers will enter. It's only the Iraqi army and Iraqi police that are going to physically enter Mosul. And they did that strategically, one, to show that they are there fighting for themselves. They're not relying on militias fight their battles. Second thing, is the whole Iraq is fighting for Iraq. Mm-hmm. That this is an Iraqi project. It's not a, you know, a militia project funded by such and such regional powers.
Yeah.
This is funded by Iraq, and the soldiers are flying the Iraqi flag, not sectarian flags, so on and so forth. So they have been taken note of, and the government is it's already starting to deal with it. And I think Mosul operation is the first time they're starting to deal with issues that are arising from PMU.
Yeah.
You will see more sort of limits that are going to be given on PMU's power and PMU's influence by the Iraqi government. And so far, the PMU is very very responsive to what Iraq demands. They always publish on their social media, at least, they always publish how they will always respect the president of Iraq.
Yeah, but I mean, part of the problem in all of this is that now the Peshmerga have invited Turkish troops to come and fight with ISIS.
That's right. Erdogan was just the other day saying he wants to be part of the liberation of Mosul.
Despite the fact that the Iraqi prime minister and the Iraqi government has said, no, thank you, we appreciate the offer, but we don't want anything to do with this. So, you know, these threats are really threatening the force or sort of the military operation, I think. But beyond that, I think, you know, to actually go back to our original point, it is how do we deal with this? It's mm-hmm. really very difficult to see how they are going to deal with this and how they are going to bring back mm-hmm. a society that's been so divided and so...
Exactly.
You know, it's only been 2 years, but these 2 years are not really... There was a window between 2003 and 2014 where it was the precursor to this. This was not did not come out of the blue. This came out of a long. And so how is Iraq going to deal with this? That's going to be the challenge, I think, for the government now, even if after they liberate Mosul, particularly after they liberate Mosul.
Are you confident that the government can address this challenge?
No, I'm not. I think the government will have a very difficult time addressing these challenges, particularly in light of, you know, the divisions in society that occurred as a result of ISIS controlling so much of Iraq's territory. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite sure that a lot of people are going to come out and say, you know, you allowed ISIS to control this much territory. You allowed ISIS to control us for this many years.
Yeah.
Where have you been? You know, and it is a question that I've been asking. I mean, if it's so easy to remove ISIS, why were they not removed mm-hmm. 6, 7, 10 a year earlier? I mean, as you can see, the liberation in all these places has been swift. It's been with minimal losses, and it hasn't been very difficult for the Iraqi mm-hmm. forces to go in and liberate ISIS with the help of the American and
maybe because and ISIS knew forces. It was coming. I mean, that's
so a possible solution with this the militias that are working rampantly throughout Iraq would be again the federalist system.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that I don't want to make it sound like that is the be all and end all solution to Iraq's problems, but. With these militias, one of the biggest gripes after 2003 was Paul Bremer's decision to mm-hmm. totally dismantle the Iraqi army.
It was a disaster.
And that was one of the major reasons why a lot of the Sunnis whose lifetime career was being in the military were now jobless.
Yeah, thrown out on the street.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think a federal system would mean that these militia groups would be integrated within the security apparatus of Iraq itself.
Mm-hmm.
However, they will not function in a military capacity.
Oh, okay.
They would have to function in an internal affairs capacity.
Okay.
So just as the different governorates and different provinces would manage their own internal affairs,
mm-hmm.
these militias security. Would have to be incorporated within that internal affair apparatus to govern their own sort of provinces.
Right.
There will still be a strong Iraqi army, which will be separate from these now welcomed in
integrated
militias that will be part of the internal affairs of Iraqi provinces.
Oh, okay.
So that might be one solution to deal with all these militias running around and fighting against ISIS.
Do you have any sense that you know, I mean, you as you said, it's not the be all to end all perfect solution, but it's certainly an option that should be considered. Do you get the sense that this is something that's on the table right now? Are people in Iraq seriously debating this?
I don't think there's anybody debating anything in Iraq other than the I think politicians and individuals are really looking at what is happening on the battlefront more than anything else.
I think most people
have lost sight of what will happen. I mean, we liberate Mosul tomorrow. Great. What happens next?
Yeah.
How do we pay? I mean, by the way, you know, part of the thing that I was thinking about the other day is this idea of transitional justice, where, you know, you have such atrocities and such crimes committed. How do you deal with it? And, you know, the United Nations and experts in human rights will tell you that in order to help a place heal, you need to actually have truth and reconciliation commissions. Yeah. You have to have actual discuss and bring the victim stories out to the forefront.
Amnesty.
And I don't think Iraq, amnesty, and I don't think Iraq is ready for that. I don't think the Iraqi government
or the Iraqi
are
too deep
people
or
are ready for this because they haven't even discussed it. They haven't even brought it forward to as a point of discussion. And we saw that even with a stupid law being passed about municipalities in the last couple of days. And instead of actually keeping this law and passing it, they've tacked on a law that actually banned alcohol from being sold and produced in Iraq, which and consumed, which actually has threatened some of the communities that were under threat by ISIS even further. Mm. And this is the central government producing this problem. So it's a very complex issue. And I think this whole idea of transitional justice should be discussed and should be part of the debate as Iraq tries to, quote-unquote, mature into a federal state, into a system that functions, into a state that functions for all Iraqis, for all citizens. Because ultimately speaking, there has to be a trust in the institutions by the people, regardless of their ethnic and religious background, in order to actually have a functioning state. And we don't have that at the moment. And that's a problem.
So just one quick question before we leave to each of you. Do you think that the residents of Mosul will view the Iraqi army as liberators or just another power?
I think that's a moot point, really. I mean, the people of Mosul, you know, my heart goes out to them. But at the same time, you know, they, in essence, welcomed ISIS and brought them in. At least there's a large swath of that. And until we go in and actually try to deal with the people that whose crimes, they committed crimes by actually allowing ISIS to come in and by, you know, helping ISIS, because there had to have been collaboration inside of the city of Mosul to actually create such mayhem. Mm-hmm. Until we deal with those people, we can't really talk about the average individual, because I think the average individual is absolutely against, you'd hope, are against, you know, ISIS.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously a lot, to answer your question, I mean, obviously it also depends how does the Iraqi army behave once it goes inside Mosul.
I mean, are they going to go and kill everybody
inside?
Are they
going to round people
up?
Or are
they, you know, or are they actually going to actually try to transition this place? And again, this whole idea of transitional justice comes into play and comes into this, you know, hopefully not another genocide is committed this time by the Iraqi army against people in Mosul, because actually the Iraqi army has a history of attacking its own citizens, starting in 1933 in the Samal massacre, going on in 58 and then again in the 60s and again in the 90s against the Kurds and then PAL campaign. And, you know, it just is a series of, you know, crimes committed by the Iraqi army against its population.
A prevailing theme.
Yeah. It sadly is. Yeah. Anyway, on that...
To be continued.
On that fun and happy note, thank you for listening, and thank you for being with me, and thank you for listening to another edition of Coffee Talk. Michael, thank you.
The pleasure's been all mine, buddy, and to our fans and listeners out there, we'll be back soon with another edition of Coffee Talk.
Yvonne, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to discuss these topics.